KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archivist. This contract position will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms, all kinds of audio formats, as well as the document and electronic archives. Priorities for this position are to manage the resource space archival database, in particular, the entry of metadata, and to support staff and volunteers during the 50th anniversary celebrations. Deadline for this position is Monday, February 5th, 2018 at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/archivist-hire-2018.
Is proud to co-sponsor U.S.-Saudi Coalition Bring Peace or War on Saturday, February 3rd from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Lincoln Performance Hall in Portland. This event will focus on Saudi wars, aggressions, and its relations with the West. Speakers include Aisha Juman, Mohammed Al-Namir, Catherine Shakhtam, and more. Again, that's U.S.-Saudi Coalition Bringing Peace or War on Saturday, February 3rd, from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Lincoln Performance Hall, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Oregon's child incarceration rate is one of the worst in the country. A new investigative report by Disability Rights Oregon found that kids in custody at NorCor, a jail in the Dalles, receive harsh discipline, including solitary confinement, for infractions such as asking what time it is or for just looking around. These kids are as young as 12 years old. Other states are reducing child incarceration. Why not Oregon? Join us on Prison Pipeline, February 5th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Imago Theater's production of Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucrece. The play runs from January 25th through February 8th at the Imago Theater in Portland. The chamber art musical The Rape of Lucrece is an intense, intimate production featuring a combination of spoken word and song. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucrece. The play runs from January 25th through February 8th at the Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the proposed Tesoro oil terminal in Vancouver, Washington has been voted down.
Florida could be facing a shortage of people to manage their huge agricultural industry due to President Trump's immigration policies.
And we'll take a look at the current violence raging through Afghanistan.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 29th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Natalie Mahdi. The Regional Arts and Culture Council is sponsoring a new coalition event called Preserve. The Preserve Coalition, in collaboration with the Geezer Gallery, is debuting their first arts project. The project is called Art and Soul Food, and it is a guided six-week writing program where older African Americans will be sharing their stories and experiences around soul food. The historical importance of soul food, its impact on quality of life, memory, relationships, generational connection, and health will be some of the topics. Preserve hopes to honor the class and will honor soul food's incredible contribution to American culture and cuisine. To sign up, call 561-543-5213 or email Francois, which is F-R-A-N-C-O-I-E, at oshu.edu.
The proposed Vancouver Oil Terminal would have been North America's largest oil train depot and on a site within blast radius of downtown Vancouver, Washington. Thanks in part to the Stand Up to Oil campaign, Northwest tribes and thousands of community members, the terminal has been voted down. Today, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee rejected the terminal, a lettered response to Tesoro Savage's application for site certification for the Vancouver Energy Distribution Terminal at the Port of Vancouver. In the letter, Inslee made clear that he supports the Council and Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council staff's unanimous recommendation to reject the application. Governor Inslee cited several reasons for upholding the decision that included the Council's research, earthquake preparedness, fire risks, and the proposed location of the facility. He closed by saying, "While this process has demonstrated that this particular project is wrong for this particular location, I am confident that our ports will continue to play an important role in regional trade and providing opportunities for jobs and clean energy."
Cryptocurrency continues to take the world by a quiet storm. Cryptocurrency is a digital currency with encryption techniques that regulate the generation of units and verify transfers without a central bank. Cryptocurrency investors have been searching for crypto-themed exchange-traded funds, but concerns around regulation have limited options until recently. Two new blockchains ETFs were launched this month that will act as digital ledgers for transactions made in Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency to be recorded chronologically and publicly. The RealityShares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy ETF and the Amplify Transformational Data Sharing ETF that plan to invest in companies researching and developing blockchain technology. According to FactSet, a financial research company, investors have given more than $240 million to blockchain ETFs within the last 2 weeks. While cryptocurrencies have gotten a lot of media attention, some experts say the blockchain decentralized verification technology is where investors should place investments. Cryptocurrency itself is based on the concept of anonymous investing, which blockchains would disrupt. Blockchain ETF successes are happening just as the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission continues to hold its ground on not approving ETFs with direct exposure to cryptocurrencies for listings on major U.S. exchanges.
President Trump's FBI nemesis, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, has announced his retirement. Insiders at the FBI expected McCabe to step down in March and were surprised at the news. McCabe will use vacation leave to shorten his presence at the FBI prior to retirement. The FBI has been investigating election meddling by Russia in the 2016 presidential campaign, determining whether there was collusion. According to CNN, Trump FBI appointee Director Christopher Wray had announced to McCabe that Wray intended to bring in his own team for the ongoing investigation. Director Wray had made it clear to McCabe that the former deputy director was not to be a part of the effort. President Trump had also blatantly pressured McCabe to resign. In December, Trump tweeted, quote, "FBI Director Andrew McCabe is racing the clock to retire with full benefits, 90 days to go." Last July, Trump tweeted, quote, "Why didn't AG Sessions replace acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, a Comey friend who was in charge of Clinton investigation but got big dollars, $700,000, for his wife's political run from Hillary Clinton and her representatives. Drain the swamp." Trump refused to answer when asked by the press about McCabe's exit, and White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that President Trump had no involvement in the surprise departure of McCabe. In Congress, reaction to the news of McCabe's decision was sharply divided on partisan lines. Trump's attorney, Jay Sekulow, speaking on his online radio show, expressed elation at the news.
A new bill is on the table that will limit campaign donations, but also incentivize small donations from ordinary people. In conjunction with Oregon News Service, at KBU Evening News, reporter Grace Ann Smith has more.
Lawmakers will introduce a bill next month that aims to empower small donors in Oregon elections. Under House Bill 4076, known as the Small Donor Elections Bill, state legislative candidates would only agree to accept donations of $250 or less. In exchange, the donations would be matched 6-to-1 through public limited funds. That means a $10 donation would be worth $70. Kate Titus, who heads the Government Accountability Group, Common Cause of Oregon, says candidates could shift their focus away from big political donors with this bill, but she notes the cost is a hurdle.
The cost, I think, has kept us from putting this reform in place in more places, but really it's a bargain to use small amounts of public funds strategically in this way so that we can own the election system ourselves and not let it be bought and paid for by special interests.
Cities around the country have adopted small donor public financing systems for elections, including Portland in 2016. In Oregon, the bill has gained support from groups that represent people of color, women, and the LGBT community, among others. Jenny Lee, with the Coalition for Communities of Color, says Oregon is becoming more diverse, yet that isn't reflected in the composition of the legislature. She says candidates of color often struggle from their lack of connections with wealthy donors, and thinks this bill is a way for candidates to bridge the wealth gap.
This is a way to mitigate the impact of income inequality and racial inequities in our economic system, in our democracy. Someone's voice should not receive less attention simply because they don't benefit from this wealth.
Titus says an astronomical amount of money has flowed into recent elections, in large part because of the Citizens United decision. The trend also comes as economic inequality grows across the country. Titus says this bill attempts to put electoral power back in the hands of ordinary citizens and quotes former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis on the need to rein in inequality.
You can have great economic inequality or you can have democracy, but you can't have both.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith. Florida has an $8 billion agricultural industry that could face worker shortages because of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. When the administration barred Haitians from U.S. visas earlier this month, claiming, quote, high levels of fraud, abuse, and a high rate of overstaying, end quote, it did more than stifle the small progress of employing Haitian people after the devastating earthquake the country suffered in 2010. Florida agriculture, according to the U.S. News and the Orlando Sentinel, is supported in part by illegal immigrants or migrants that enter the country legally but stay on illegally to work. The state's farmers, harvesters, and packers are adamant that the industry runs on H-2A visas, and disrupting the program could prove extremely devastating. The H-2A temporary visa is good for up to 10 months, but does not provide citizenship. When the agricultural season is over, workers are expected to return home. Home is usually Mexico or Central American, with Haitians being part of the percentage. Florida leads the nation in H-2A worker positions that are certified by the Department of Labor. In 2017, the department recorded an estimated 25,000 visa holders in Florida, roughly one quarter of the 100,000 eligible crop workers. Florida's top agriculture products are vegetables and fruits, taking first place for tomatoes, watermelons, grapefruit, and sugarcane.
President Trump's first State of the Union address will be tomorrow, Tuesday, January 30th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. The speech will take place before a joint session of Congress. House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, presides in the House chamber of the U.S. Capitol that evening with Mike Pence in his constitutional role as President of the Senate. Congress, Supreme Court justices, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all but one of President Trump's cabinet, also known as the Designated Survivor, will be present. The Designated Survivor is a singular cabinet official asked to sit out on the address and watch from a distant location. All major networks and cable news channels will broadcast the speech live. It will also be streamed from the White House's website. Projections are expecting the State of the Union speech to be about an hour. However, there is no set length. According to the American Presidency Project, President Bill Clinton holds the record for the lengthiest address, clocking in at 89 minutes, while President Ronald Reagan holds the record for being the shortest at close to 31 minutes. Last year, Trump spoke to Congress in a joint address, which was not a formal State of the Union, and which lasted approximately an hour. Last week, the White House announced that President Trump would reveal his complete immigration policy plan before the State of the Union. According to Politico, Trump will focus on a theme of unity as he attempts to appeal to a divided Congress. Senior policy advisor Stephen Miller and staff secretary Rob Porter have been taking the lead on writing the speech, which includes highlighting strong economic growth in the U.S., the benefits of recent tax changes, and an America First trade policy.
Climate Connections is a daily podcast aimed at pulling the conversation away from the argument of global warming and towards how it affects us daily and how we can help.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Hawaiian island of Kauai has pristine beaches, lush palm trees, and lots of sunshine. And the island utility is turning that sunshine into a lot of solar power.
In 7 years, from 2010 to 2017, we've gone from 8% renewable and 92% oil to 45% renewable and 55% oil today.
Brad Rockwell with the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative says that on a sunny day, the island produces enough solar energy to meet all of its electricity demands.
We have basically hit that saturation level where we cannot build any more large-scale solar projects because we're already maxed out with the amount of solar we have during the midday.
So the co-op is now investing in batteries. For example, one new solar facility has a battery system that stores solar power to use at night or on cloudy days.
By continuing to build more and more of these projects, we should be able to significantly offset even our nighttime oil consumption.
And Rockwell says that will allow Kauai to reach 70% renewable energy by 2030, a decade before the goal set by the state. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced Friday it was suspending its effort to withdraw proposed restrictions for the Bristol Bay watershed in Alaska for mining and will seek additional public comment. The EPA stated mining likely poses a risk to natural resources. Native and environmental groups, which are fighting the proposed large open-pit copper and gold pebble mine, were among those to react to the news. Alana Hurley is with United Tribes of Bristol Bay.
These proposed protections, the fact that the Trump administration is choosing to keep them in place and keep them on the shelf is a recognition Pebble Mine is too toxic even for the Trump administration.
In a statement, Pebble Limited Partnership says the announcement does not change plans for the mine. Reporter Daisha Eaton tells us more about the project.
Pebble Limited Partnership spokesperson Mike Heatwool says there are several notable changes to their plans in the application.
The size difference compared to our early estimates of 12.7 square miles is now at about 10.7 square miles. We've been able to make the facilities in and around the proposed mine site more compact. We're proposing a natural gas pipeline from the Kenai Peninsula across Cook Inlet and then under Eliamna Lake in order to get natural gas to our mine site in order to run our electrical generation.
In addition, the application shows the company wants to build roads, an ice-breaking ferry, and a port on Cook Inlet to transport minerals out. The Army Corps will select a third-party contractor to administer the environmental impact statement process. Then they'll move into the scoping process, which is where the public can weigh in. Alana Hurley with United Tribes of Bristol Bay, a group opposing the mine, says the permit application confirms their concerns.
There is no way that the current application will not impact salmon. We're still talking about tons of toxic waste that would have to be stored forever at the headwaters of our watershed, miles and miles of road and pipeline, a mega port. It's still a mega mine.
She says even as the project moves into the permitting stage, the resistance to the proposed pebble mine isn't going anywhere.
You know, this is really a national issue. It's a global issue. And we need people from across the nation to weigh in and help us protect this global resource for future generations.
The application became public in early January, and the permitting process should unfold over 2018. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Canada's Minister of Indigenous Services recently gave an update on challenges facing her department. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
The Minister of Indigenous Services, Jane Philpott, also laid out the goals of her new department. Its aim is to improve the quality of life and help move the centralized approach away from the federal government in Ottawa, where all decision-making takes place. The Prime Minister announced last summer that he was splitting the Indigenous Affairs Department in two, with the former handling land claims and self-governance. And Philpott's new department has taken over programs on health, child welfare, education, and infrastructure. Philpott says the ultimate goal in each of these areas is to eventually turn over responsibility to First Nations organizations.
We know that the way forward is self-determination. And one of the best examples of that is in British Columbia, where we have seen the tremendous success of the British Columbia First Nations Health Authority, which has entirely taken over the leadership, the management, and the delivery of health services for First Nations in British Columbia.
Philpott also says child welfare on reserves is a main priority and lack of money for education. On that issue, she says high school graduation rates on reserves are half what they are in the rest of Canada. She also says there are shortfalls in infrastructure on reserves, with overcrowded, dilapidated housing and shortages in water treatment facilities. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice.
KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Dr. Niraja Havaligi on her upcoming course at the Portland Underground Grad School. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 7, it's Prison Pipeline. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of around 40 degrees, followed by more rain and a high of about 45. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it'll also be rainy with a high of around 40 degrees. Today in history is a big day for Kansas. It was admitted to the Union as a free state in the year 1861. In an effort to determine Kansas's future as either a free state or a slave state, droves of settlers moved there and battled it out regularly, earning the state the name Bleeding Kansas. The quote of the day is from Kansan Charles Curtis, who became the first Native American senator on this day in 1907, who later went on to serve as vice president. Bias and prejudice are attitudes to be kept in hand, not attitudes to be avoided.
Current Cast is a daily podcast highlighting one of our most precious resources, water. Today, they are exploring the origins of the Great Lakes.
Why Michigan's Lower Peninsula is shaped like a mitten on this Current Cast. Let's go back about 14,000 years to what's now the Great Lakes region. Back then, the entire area was covered with a sheet of ice that averaged a half mile thick, but was up to four times that in some places. As temperatures warmed, the melting glacier moved slowly toward Canada, its massiveness gouging the land beneath it, leaving behind a handful of deep depressions. Meltwater filled those newly created basins, and voila, the Great Lakes were born, although they didn't take their final form for a few thousand more years. So, thanks to a glacier, we have five fantastic freshwater lakes and the familiar Michigan Mitt, a Hand-E landmark that is easily recognizable from space. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at currentcast.org.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day striking worker Anna Lopiazzo was shot and killed by local police during the pivotal Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. In what is considered one of the most important strikes in American labor history, the industrial workers of the world had organized a strike that brought out more than 30,000 textile mill workers at the American Woolen Company. Workers had been on strike for most of the month, picketing, marching, giving speeches, and stopping scabs. Their banners demanded a living wage and dignity, bread and roses. That day, there were workers' parades among pitched battles between strikers, police, and scabs. Gunfire erupted. According to Big Bill Haywood, 19 witnesses saw police officer Oscar Benoit shoot Anna Lopiazzo. The shooting provided the mill owners with an opportunity to crack down on the strike. Martial law was instituted, and all public meetings and marches were banned. The leading IWW strike organizers, John Edor and Arturo Giovanetti, were arrested for her murder, despite the fact that they were 2 miles away from the scene. Though they were eventually acquitted, their imprisonment removed them from directing the day-to-day work of the strike. But who was Anna Lopiazzo? According to Bruce Watson, author of Bread and Roses, Mills, Migrants, and the Struggle for the American Dream, if America had a tomb of the unknown immigrant paying tribute to the millions of immigrants known only to God and distant cousins compiling family trees, Anna Lopiazzo would be a prime candidate to lie in it. And indeed she was for 88 years, until retired IBEW 2321 business manager David Morris worked to get a headstone decorated with the Bread and Roses symbol of grain stalks and a rose for her pauper's grave.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
A new threat to military security has been revealed. Military members using the fitness app Strava could have inadvertently breached security when they turned on their devices. The app, which shares data and running routes, internationally released a global heat map of running routes used by all of its users. This map showed several well-known military bases, but also revealed covert ones. This breach was discovered by a 20-year-old analyst, Nathan Reuser, from the Institute for United Conflict Analysis. He pointed out on Twitter that, quote, U.S. bases are clearly identifiable and mappable, end quote. Major Audricia Harris told the Associated Press that, quote, the DOD takes matters like this very seriously and is reviewing the situation to determine if any additional training or guidance is required, and if any additional policy must be developed to ensure the continued safety of DOD personnel at home and abroad, end quote.
Money Matters is a podcast about how money affects our lives. Today they take a look at cash versus insurance.
Welcome to another edition of Money Matters. My name's Mark Cuniberti. On a recent visit to the local hospital near my home to get a rather involved medical test, I compared the cost of paying cash to paying by insurance. I told them, due to my type of insurance, called a fraternal insurance company, I would pay cash and then get a receipt to submit it to the insurance company. This is regarded by the hospital as what it is, a cash payment collected at time of visit. The cost for a cash payment was $1,780. If I had paid by insurance, the cost that would have been billed to the insurance company was $2,620. That works out to a difference of about $840, or almost one-third cheaper if you pay by cash. One would then ask the question, what is it about getting paid by an insurance company to the hospital versus cash that requires the hospital to charge a third more? Having to wait for a payment by the hospital might be one reason, but even an extremely high usury rate while they wait for their money, the opportunity cost, which is the use of money I paid up front versus waiting for the insurance company to pay them, certainly amounts to but a few dollars. Assuming an unheard-of rate of a return based on current interest rates of maybe 10% or so, which the hospital likely gets nowhere to that, and assuming a liberal 90-day pay period, in other words, it takes the hospital 90 days to get paid by the insurance company, the cost incurred by the hospital for waiting versus a cash payment amounts to less than about $100. So what other costs does a hospital incur when dealing with an insurance company versus a cash payment, which would amount to the remaining $740? That question does boggle the mind, at least my mind, since shipping and handling actually processing and handling, pun intended, is the only major cost I can imagine that is incurred in dealing with an insurance company. Just how involved and costly is that entire process to the hospital? Apparently, since they give such a good cash discount, it's very involved. The required paperwork for the insurance company is detailed, the submittal process exacting, and the kickback rate significant, since the old adage is an insurance company's secret mission is to keep the money as long as they can. You can imagine there are many landmines in the paper trail awaiting an inexperienced clerical worker in crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's when submitting an application for payment to an insurance company. Even experienced clerical managers can make mistakes on the pile of forms that is probably required by an insurance company for a claim submittal. Resubmissions can be required, and every box left unchecked by the hospital or checked incorrectly means a longer wait for the hospital until the reimbursement check arrives. Of course, should legal issues arise in the payment that requires the services of a lawyer by the hospital to recoup a denied claim or loss, the hospital will pay that out of its pocket as well. That cost is therefore assumed by the hospital as a reoccurrence at a presumed rate and is then built into the insurance rate as well. Sit over a cup of coffee for a while, and the possibilities of what problems could arise when transmitting and transacting complicated medical procedures by a hospital to an insurance company can occupy one's mind for hours. I know, and I did it, and I basically gave up after an hour or so, after compiling quite a list of things that could go wrong when dealing with a profit-driven insurance conglomerate and trying to get them to cut the hospital a check. Never mind the government requirements heaped on the poor processing souls of the hospital when dealing with an Obamacare, Medicare, Medi-Cal, or other government entity. After an hour or two of listing all the pitfalls and requirements that does and could befall a processing hospital or doctor, I'm surprised that a 30% surcharge of cash versus insurance payments covers all of it. And that's one of the reasons your medical costs are skyrocketing. It's just very costly to process payments through insurance. They would instead rather be paid by you in cold hard cash. It's a lot cheaper for you and a lot less hassle for them. And that does it for another edition of Your Money Matters. Please remember, discussions in this newscast should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Our website is moneymanagementradio.com. My name's Mark Cuneberti.
Nineteen-year-old Oliver Crane from New Jersey just became the youngest person to roll solo across the Atlantic Ocean last Sunday. He arrived on the Caribbean island of Antigua to a roaring and cheering crowd that included his friends and family. Crane broke the previous record for the youngest solo crossing set in 2010 by then 22-year-old Katie Spotts. Crane's 3,000-mile journey was completed in 44 days after beginning in the Canary Islands on December 14th in his custom-built boat named Team Homeward Bound. The boat has a solar-powered water maker and is designed to right itself if capsized. There was no toilet on board. Oliver Crane used a bucket while traveling. Crane told ABC News he had two satellite phones on board to communicate with his team on shore, who were assisting him with navigation and weather forecasts. He also received texts from his family to keep him on task and encouraged. When asked about nutrition, he said, "I ate mainly junk food. I was supposed to eat freezer-dried food as my main energy source, but I had a hard time getting it down, so I lived off Pringles and candy for a long time."
A recent study has shown mosquitoes have a preference and a memory. Their memories, or also called aversive learning, is aided by a release of dopamine in the brain. As to what attracts mosquitoes to individuals, scientists are still baffled. Chloe Launder, a research assistant professor at the Department of Biochemistry at Virginia Tech, states that, "Unfortunately, there is no way of knowing exactly what attracts a mosquito to a particular human. Individuals are made up of unique molecular cocktails that include combinations of more than 400 chemicals. However, we now know that mosquitoes are able to learn odors emitted by their host
and avoid those that were more defensive. If you happen to be the one of those people that seem to be attracting all the mosquitoes, you may be comforted to know that the same mosquito will remember a swat and avoid you in the future.
The Public News Service is a member-supported broadcast that aims to shed light on meaningful and underreported news. Here is today's roundup.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, January the 29th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Mayors call on President Donald Trump to help pave the way to progress. Also on our nationwide rundown, billionaires made enough in 2017 to end poverty seven times over. And we'll take you to the state some say is out in front in fighting sexual assault. Now our top story, Republican lawmakers warned President Trump on Sunday not to fire Robert Mueller. But the New York Times reports they also showed little sense of urgency to advance long-stalled legislation that would protect the special counsel. This comes despite last week's Times report that Trump had tried to remove Mueller last June. The Times quotes House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy as saying, "I don't think there's a need for legislation right now to protect Mueller. Right now there's not an issue, so why create one when there isn't a place for it?" North Carolina mayors joining others across the nation to let Washington know about roadblocks in their pursuit of growth because of lack of funding for infrastructure and transportation projects.
Mayors from Asheville, Rocky Mount, Durham, Raleigh, and other North Carolina cities spent last week in Washington for the bipartisan U.S. Conference of Mayors annual conference. Durham Mayor Steve Shule says funding for infrastructure goes beyond more roads and repaired bridges.
Every time we build a road, it fills up. We're either going to take people off the roads and have a multimodal system of transportation in North Carolina, or we're going to be stuck in gridlock forever.
Durham is planning a light rail project, but will need additional federal funding to complete it. The fund that currently pays for most federal highway and transit is projected to be out of money in roughly 3 years, unless more funding is authorized. Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarlane says it's important for North Carolina's residents to understand that smooth rides to work and school don't happen without effort. President Trump is expected to address the issue of infrastructure in his State of the Union address on Tuesday night. This is Stephanie Carson reporting.
Nationwide, the U.S. Census Bureau projects that the country will gain nearly 26 million new residents by 2020. That's an increase of about 8%. North Carolina is expected to grow even faster at a rate of 11%. And last year, billionaires saw their wealth increase enough to end extreme poverty around the world seven times over. Eric Tegetoff tells us that's according to the Reward Work Not Wealth report from the global charity Oxfam.
It says 82% of the wealth created in 2017 went to the top 1%, and that a new billionaire was created every 2 days. Paul O'Brien, Oxfam America's vice president for policy and advocacy, says this growing inequality isn't good news for workers.
It's not a good time to be a worker on the wrong end of the economic chain. What we essentially have are market economies where the markets aren't being regulated and the rules are essentially being rigged by those who can afford to do so. And that's where you see extreme wealth emerging and people getting stuck.
Some have criticized the report, saying it buries the good news that the bottom 50% of income earners around the world actually are doing better than previously thought. The report focuses on the inequality women face in the workplace. It says women provided an estimated $10 trillion in unpaid work caring for someone else in 2017.
From the 1974 Safe Drinking Water Act to the Climate Agreement, environmentalists have celebrated regulations that curb pollution, reduce carbon emissions, and protected the oceans. Ross Brown reports now the Trump administration argues those same environmental regulations are burdensome and kill U.S. jobs and hamstring the economy.
Already, the Clean Water Rule is threatened, the resumption of offshore drilling has been proposed, and withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord has been promised. Bob Deans with the National Resources Defense Council, a top environmental advocacy group, calls the current environmental assault reckless.
We've just seen one attempt after the next from the first day this president took office to roll back the common sense safeguards we all depend on and to turn our back on the central environmental challenge of our time, of course. Climate change.
In a letter to supporters over the weekend, the NRDC said it was preparing a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency for the rollback of protections under Trump, calling the federal court system the best antidote to the agency's policies.
The NRDC says it is gearing up to file suits on dozens of fronts in the year ahead.
And finally, Tramell Gomes reports, thanks to the Maryland General Assembly's passage of several laws to help victims of sexual assault, some victim advocates claim the state is ahead of the nation in handling these cases.
Last year, several laws took effect, including a provision known as no means no, meaning evidence of physical resistance is not required to prove that a sexual crime has been committed. The Maryland General Assembly now has formed a commission to examine workplace policies on sexual harassment in all three branches of state government. Lisa Jordan with the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault has been named a member.
The Maryland General Assembly is ahead of the country in terms of responding to issues of sexual assault. They made policy changes after the Billy Bush Trump tape and have continued to update their policies.
The General Assembly's Workplace Harassment Commission consists of 11 other women and 2 men. The panel will review state policies and solicit input from business leaders, the public, and policy experts, and make recommendations to the Legislative Policy Committee.
The state's latest sexual harassment policy and procedures are available at the Maryland Department of Budget Management website. That address is dam.maryland.gov. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford from Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now, in water-related news, we go to today's Week in Water.
A major world city could run out of water. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
April 12th. They are calling it Day Zero. It sounds ominous, and it is.
Day Zero is when water faucets in Cape Town, South Africa, could go dry. The city, with its 4 million residents, a bit larger than metropolitan Seattle, is facing its worst drought in close to a century.
Most of the region is recovering from El Niño's recent effects, but not Cape Town, now in its third year of dryness. The average level of area reservoirs is around 27%, but about a third of that is not usable due to debris and mud.
Officials are urging people to take drastic conservation measures. The premier of Western Cape government, Helen Zille, is calling for everyone to use less than 13 gallons of water per person per day. In comparison, the national average use in the U.S. is about 90 gallons, according to the USGS.
The government is also asking people to turn off the water supply to their toilet tanks. Instead, they should reuse the gray water in homes from shower runoff and dishwashing to fill toilet tanks and to flush them only when necessary.
The premier said no one should shower more than twice a week and noted that oily hair in a drought is as much of a status symbol as a dusty car.
Hurricane Harvey hit the southeast area of Texas in August, dumping record amounts of rain. But now 40% of the state is in moderate to severe drought, including some areas where the hurricane hit.
Mark Wenzel with the state's Water Development Board told the Texas Tribune that as soon as Hurricane Harvey cleared Texas, the state almost immediately started going into the next drought.
The worst areas are in the Texas Panhandle, with the lack of moisture spreading north into western Oklahoma and Kansas.
According to Texas State climatologist John Nielsen Gammon, climate change is driving the extremes, in addition to the La Niña weather pattern in the Pacific Ocean. He added that climate models show storms will become less frequent and more intense.
The Trump administration has drafted an infrastructure proposal for building roads, bridges, and pipelines across the U.S., which includes scaling back environmental protections that have been in place for decades.
The Washington Post obtained the draft, which includes the most sweeping changes in many years about how the federal government approves and oversees projects. Critics say the plans would gut environmental protections like those in the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Clean Air Act.
Review of projects such as pipelines would be limited and new deadlines imposed to speed up approvals. Some agencies would be entirely cut out of the review process if another agency already issued its approval. And another provision would exempt agency decisions from review by courts.
The outline would allow the Interior Secretary to approve natural gas pipelines across national parks instead of requiring congressional approval.
Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, Watch said in a statement that Trump is using his infrastructure plans to attack the environment and that the last thing needed is to expedite approvals of pipelines that endanger water, communities, and the climate.
A White House official told the Washington Post that the document was only a discussion draft, but some who are familiar with it said many of its proposals are the basis for ongoing negotiations with lawmakers.
Environmental organizations and commercial fishermen might sue if the EPA fails to protect endangered species from widely used chemicals.
Last month, the U.S. National Marine Fisheries Service issued a report nearly 4,000 pages long, finding that three pesticides used on farms and orchards posed a threat to dozens of endangered and threatened species.
The three compounds, chlorpyrifos, diazinon, and malathion, are used on fruits, nuts, alfalfa, and other farm products. The chemicals run off into rivers and oceans where they threaten various creatures.
Patty Goldman of Earth Justice told E&E News that the pesticides are a major threat to endangered salmon and orcas that eat that salmon. The populations of both have dwindled recently near Seattle.
A representative of a fishermen's association told The Guardian that his $1 billion a year industry has lost thousands of jobs as salmon stocks have shrunk due to the overdevelopment of dams and the use of dangerous pesticides.
Last year, however, EPA head Scott Pruitt overturned an Obama administration effort to ban the use of chlorpyrifos, which, in only tiny levels of exposure, can harm the development of children's brains. And finally, there's a craze you've probably noticed trending in the news. Bitcoin, the encrypted digital currency that operates without banks or governments or any middleman.
What makes Bitcoin secure is that funds are tracked by something called blockchain technology, where transactions are listed in a public online ledger and no one person can alter or delete entries.
Many companies and retailers are jumping on the blockchain bandwagon for its ability to be transparent, something the conservation organization World Wildlife Fund is betting will have an aquatic angle too, tracking tuna.
According to the news site The Conversation, World Wildlife Fund wants to stop illegal and unregulated fishing, as well as human rights abuses in the tuna industry, so they've just launched a pilot project in the Pacific Islands that will use blockchain technology to track a fish from bait to plate.
When a tuna is caught, it will be tagged with a code, and then devices on the vessel, at the dock, and in the factory will be able to detect the tags and automatically upload its information to the blockchain.
For consumers, it means being able to scan a code on a fish in the store to trace its journey and know it's been sustainably, environmentally, and ethically caught.
The World Wildlife Fund is not the only one using blockchain. A company called Providence has been using the technology to trace tuna from Indonesian fisheries for British consumers. Providence also tracks cotton and coffee, according to Gizmodo.
Increasingly, government agencies, such as the U.S. Department of Energy, are using blockchain technology for transparency and security.
Sounds like a good trend if public departments are getting on board to make sure there's nothing fishy going on in our government. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
IKEA lovers everywhere are bowing their heads today. IKEA founder Ingvar Kamprad, who managed to turn a small-scale mail-order business on his family's farm into an international furniture-fueled force of nature, died today at the age of 91. Kamprad's signature stamp on furniture was to let customers piece together his simple and often inexpensive furniture selections themselves. IKEA Group's president Jesper Broden said that Kamprad's legacy will be admired in future years to come and that his vision to create a, quote, better everyday life for many people, end quote, will continue to guide and inspire. Kamprad started IKEA at the age of 17.
After 16 years and 31,000 civilian deaths, the U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan is increasingly threatened by Afghan armed resistance. The Afghans have shifted to suicide car bombs and death platoons to remove the U.S. invaders. A five-person group of fighters and suicide bombers attacked the Afghan capital, Kabul, today, killing 11 and injuring 16 before they were themselves killed. ISIS claimed responsibility for the action through its news agency. The attack follows on a Taliban car bombing using an ambulance, which last week killed 103 people, also in Kabul. In the past month, Afghan and anti-occupation soldiers have attacked a cultural center, an aid agency, and the Intercontinental Hotel in the capital city. Thomas Ruddig, an analyst quoted in the Los Angeles Times, said that as attacks increase, there is a mutually escalating spiral of violence. U.S. President Trump has already directed an increase of more than 5,000 troops, bringing the total to more than 13,000 currently in the country, with thousands more present as mercenaries and logistics support. Outside Kabul, the Taliban now controls, or effectively controls, 40% of the Afghan territories. According to a report by the Watson Institute at Brown University, the cost of the U.S.-Afghan war now exceeds $830 billion, and the cycle of U.S. wars since the invasion of Iraq in 1991 has now cost $4.79 trillion.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Zelos Ellis Marchant, Grace Ann Smith, and Kyle Carezzi. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Cara Drennan, professor of law at Catholic University, talks about the justice system's war on kids. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, Stage and Studio D May features the first ever Black History Festival Northwest with director Shalonda Sims and her play Who I Am Celebrating Me. At 11:30, Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Zemi Barr, exhibition manager of the new show Robert Frank, Books and Films, 1947 to 2018 at the Blue Sky Gallery. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can also get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland Underground Graduate School, or PUGS, is based on the idea that you can't stop learning at any point of your life. Our goal is to create a lifelong learning community that works for everyone's real lives. That means education that fits in work schedules and are priced to be accessible to all. We're here to provide Portlanders with grad school level education that everyone can afford. As stated on their website, local experts with real life experience in the field are your teachers. We believe that knowledge isn't locked up in the ivory tower, it's everywhere and in everyone. We provide a platform for local experts to share their knowledge and insight with others without the high cost or bureaucracy of the university system. We're fundamentally about lifelong education for social justice, personal empowerment, and Portland civics.
We have in the studio Dr. Niraja Havaligi, if I said that correctly,
yes.
Who's teaching a course on how to learn crop diversity. She believes this is a necessity to sustaining the global food resources. So welcome, Dr. Havaligi.
Thank you.
So when were you first interested in studying agriculture?
The first fascination for plant life happened very early, as much as when I was three or before. I was always fascinated with plants and life around me. And my dad was an agriculture scientist. Mom was an experimenter in the kitchen. My aunts and grandparents had home gardens. So I grew up around food.
It was like a natural just course.
It was a natural progression, so I didn't surprise myself going to study agriculture.
So what actually is crop diversity? If you can enlighten us a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So, the different types of crops that form our food base. And I'm talking only about crop diversity, as in, let's say we have tomatoes. We have 10 different varieties of tomatoes. And then we have potatoes, and we have so many other types of vegetables, fruits, and different types of nuts. All those things fall into the category of crop diversity.
So it's just like kind of how there's many different kinds of apples that sprung from maybe a few.
Absolutely. Many varieties of apples, many variations in the same crop, many crop variations per se. It is interspecific, intraspecific, that kind of thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
So is crop diversity and agrobiodiversity the same thing?
Yes. And yes and no. In the sense, crop diversity sits in the agrobiodiversity. Agrobiodiversity is the bigger structure which has insects, microbes, and all sorts of, the biome which actually forms and feeds the agricultural system. So it's the whole ecosystem, all the natural resources that and living abiotic and biotic resources, that becomes agrobiodiversity. When I'm talking about crops, I'm talking only about crops.
A very small specialization.
Yes.
And does the crop diversity technique vary from country to country? Is there a different kind?
Different types of diversity, you mean?
Yes.
As in, there are what we say countries of origin, where there is richer diversity of crops, as in crop varieties. If I go to Syria, or if I go to India, or different parts of Asia, or South America, or in Mexico, there is a diversity of maize. That is the ancestor of all the maize we use.
Oh, the corn.
Yeah,
where corn came from. And
yes. So, yeah.
Okay, so when and where is the crop diversity PUGS class?
The PUGS class is at Southeast Uplift, 3534 Southeast Main Street. And that's the location of PUGS class. And if you check them out on PUGS PDX, you can see all the details of the course. And it starts on February 1st. It's on every Thursday, 6:30 to 8:30.
And are you going to be teaching other classes about crop diversity or any other classes in general at PUGS?
I hope to in the near future.
So is this your first class?
This is my first class, yes. And I'm excited, looking forward to it.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm excited for you. Mm-hmm. So what other resources are there for people who are interested in sustainable foods?
For us in Portland, we have farmers markets to start with. We have community gardens, and then we have the sustainable food program. City of Portland has, if you look for City of Portland sustainable food program, they have a database, and you can actually look at the different sustainable food options we have. The other one which I like to bring here is also mentioned here is about farm-to-table restaurants. Typical ones where you can actually source, you can trace your food.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome. Well, we are probably about running out of time. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, Dr. Havaligi, for telling us a little bit about crop diversity.
I mean, totally interested in that class. It's at 3534 Southeast Main Street?
Yes, and it's at Southeast Uplift. That's what you should look on the map for, Google Maps.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And you can find out more information on Pugs PDX.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's Natalie Mahdi for KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church in Portland. The Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival features seven new music performers, performing works by living composers, both well-known and lesser-known, as well as some works by recently deceased 20th century composers. Music by Lou Harrison, Jacob Druckmann, Julia Wolf, David Lang, and many, many more. Again, that's the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 35th Annual Real Music Film Festival, taking place January 12th through January 30th at the Northwest Film Center. New works and classics are featured this year, including Charles Mingus, Triumph of the Underdog, Chavela, Long Strange Trip, The Untold Story of the Grateful Dead, The Big Beat, Fats Domino and the Birth of Rock and Roll, and many, many more. Again, that's the 35th Annual Real Music Film Festival, taking place January 12th through the 30th. All screenings are at the Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as